A Russian soldier in Ukraine is on trial for alleged war crimes. Israeli police charge into a funeral procession. And computer hackers wreak havoc on the government of Costa Rica. And they're demanding a steep ransom.
What I tell people is, if you can avoid it, never pay the ransom, which is what it sounds like Costa Rica is doing. Unfortunately, that just means it's a long slog to recover.
I'm Carol Hills. Also ahead, a new children's book about Indigenous Canadians.
These stories chip away at all kinds of ignorance, and it shows that we're a dynamic culture, and we're ordinary families.
And South Africans' morning toast is missing something essential. There's a shortage of Marmite.
It's one of the few things that can really genuinely be said to transcend the boundaries of race and class in South Africa.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. For the first time since the war in Ukraine began at the end of February, a Russian soldier appeared in court today. He's accused of committing war crimes in Ukraine. That's the sound of photojournalists snapping shots of 21-year-old Vadim Shishimarin. He appeared handcuffed before a district court in Kyiv for a preliminary hearing today. To give us the details of this case, we turn to Sergei Vasilyev. He's a professor of international criminal law at the University of Amsterdam.
Vadim Shishimarin is a Russian soldier, a commander of a tank, who stands accused of a war crime, and it is alleged that he shot dead a civilian, 62-year-old man who was riding his bicycle, speaking on the phone when the Russian forces were withdrawing from that village. And in order for him not to report them to the Ukrainian forces or authorities, Vadim Shishimarin received an order to shoot this civilian, which he did. As the Ukrainian authorities alleged, he saw that the civilian fell and then he rode away.
How do we know about the details of these charges and accusations? Where do the court get these details?
The principal source here would be the Ukrainian authorities. I believe that the security service of Ukraine detained Vadim Shishimarin. They must have interrogated him. At least these were the images that they shared of him being in detention. I'm not sure about any witnesses. Probably some of the additional evidence is on the case file, but for now it seems that the main source would be his own confession.
So the case against Vadim Shishimarin is being tried in Ukraine. How will the trial proceedings work?
The trial proceedings will be carried out in accordance with the Criminal Procedure Code of Ukraine. So Vadim Shishimarin is an accused in a criminal case. He has been assigned a lawyer by court. The lawyer would represent his interests. Of course, it is of utmost importance that this trial is conducted in accordance with trial guarantees. He must receive a due process. This is not only important for Vadim Shishimarin himself. It is also highly important for the judicial system of Ukraine to demonstrate that it is in a position to conduct such war crime trials in accordance with the due process, thereby providing legitimacy to such domestic proceedings. Because especially in such a fraud context, it can be alleged that the proceedings are not being held fairly, that the court is not impartial. So in order to counteract such narratives, it is indeed important that all fair trial guarantees are complied with.
It's interesting. I'm wondering, is it unusual that a war crime case is being brought to court so quickly as the war still rages on?
Well, I wouldn't say that it is highly unusual. It appears that this was a low-hanging fruit for the Ukrainian authorities in the sense that the members of the division where Shishimarin served, they were taken as prisoners of war, they were detained. So basically, he was already in detention, and therefore he could have been put on trial very easily. So it all depends on the circumstances. Of course, he's a relatively low-level commander. It's a low-profile case, but it is important, and this is why we're now discussing it, because it is the first. But many more would follow, and according to the information that we have now, in the coming weeks, we can expect several more cases to be brought to court.
Many international organizations have been collecting information about potential war crimes in Ukraine. How do they determine if a case should be tried in a Ukrainian court or at the International Criminal Court?
Indeed, many organizations, including non-governmental organizations, are participating in the collection of evidence. So next to the law enforcement authorities of the Ukraine, the members of the Office of the Prosecutor General of Ukraine, it all depends, again, on the circumstances of the case. When it comes to relatively straightforward and low-profile cases such as this one, there is no need whatsoever to transfer it to another jurisdiction, to another country, or to the International Criminal Court, because this is a case which can perfectly be dealt with by the Ukrainian authorities themselves. The International Criminal Court would normally not get involved where a state is itself active, but maybe when it comes to high-profile accused at the level of general, or when it comes to accused that are particularly notorious, not some 21-year-old tank commander, then it would be perhaps more justified for the International Criminal Court to spend its resources and bring that case to a court. And when it comes to the responsibility of high state officials of the Russian Federation, for instance, then the SEC would certainly want to be the one dealing with that case. But then the question always arises, can Ukraine not deal with such a case on its own? Because if it is in a position to do so, then the SEC should not really get involved. It is a court of last resort.
Sergei Vasilyev is a professor of international criminal law at the University of Amsterdam. He's been talking to us about the first case of a Russian soldier who's about to be tried in Ukraine for a potential war crime. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
This week, Costa Rica's president declared a state of emergency. The reason? A month of devastating cyber attacks. As of January 2022, Conti ransomware has been able to extract more than $150 million from victims worldwide. That's according to the FBI. Alan Liska is a ransomware researcher at Recorded Future, a cybersecurity company based in Massachusetts. He joins us today from Palo Alto, California. Alan, declaring a state of emergency is rather dramatic. What kind of damage are these cyber attacks inflicting on Costa Rica?
So it's a pretty broad swath of attacks. Conti apparently was able to gain access to large portions of the Costa Rican government and disrupt services in a number of critical offices. So, for example, court dockets have been disrupted, so they've had to cancel sessions there. Some of the main government offices haven't been able to function, so travel's been disrupted. Things that have direct impact not just on government employees, but on the constituents.
In this case, what are the cyber criminals demanding?
I think the last I saw, the ransom demand from Conti for Costa Rica was $11 million. So normally it is for whoever's attacked. But in the case of the country, this is for the entire country of Costa Rica.
So who or what is this Conti ransomware group? What do we know about them?
Yeah, so Conti is a what we call a ransomware as a service offering. There's a core group of the people behind Conti, the operators, as we call them, that are based in Russia. But they actually have affiliates all over the world. And the affiliates, it almost works like multi-level marketing, where the affiliates pay money to be part of Conti, and then they carry out their own ransomware attacks, and the core operators of Conti take care of the processing of the ransom payments and then distribute the money back to the different affiliates.
So it's been established, and it's a fact, that the head of this organization, Conti, they are in Russia?
Yes, yes. In fact, Conti is in a unique situation because when Russia invaded Ukraine earlier this year, Conti posted to their extortion site like full-throated support of the Russian campaign and that they were going to go after enemies of Russia. Well, Conti is technically a global organization with affiliates from around the world, and that didn't sit well with a lot of their affiliates. And so, like, 2 years' worth of chats and documents and so on were all leaked and made public. So we actually have a really good insight into how the Conti organization is run, more so than any other ransomware group that we've encountered.
So if that's the case, how should Costa Rica respond?
What I tell people is if you can avoid it, never pay the ransom, which is what it sounds like Costa Rica is doing. Unfortunately, that just means it's a long slog to recover. As far as, you know, how to respond directly, unfortunately, even though this is a nation state like attack in that you're, you know, targeting and disrupting activities at a national level, Conti themselves aren't nation state actors. So even though they're based in Russia, they're not agents of the Russian government. Yeah, you know, there's no way, unfortunately, to know for sure. And they won't leave Russia to give us a chance to find out. But to the best of our knowledge, they are strictly a cyber criminal group that just happens to have contacts within the Russian government.
So knowing all you do about Conti, why is Costa Rica the target this time around?
So we have to think about the way ransomware groups target. So if I'm a nation state actor specifically, and I say, hey, Costa Rica is my enemy, I'm going to go find vulnerabilities in Costa Rica and infiltrate them. Ransomware actors work a little bit differently. They start with known vulnerabilities and then go after targets that are vulnerable to those that they can exploit. So it's not that Costa Rica was a target, it's that they likely had a technology or a vulnerability that was easy for the ransomware groups to exploit and gain access.
And what are those vulnerabilities? Are they tech vulnerabilities?
It's a combination. So there's a number of ways that ransomware groups gain initial, what we call initial access, so get their foothold into the network. Phishing is a really common way. Password reuse is also really, really common. There are literally billions of usernames and passwords available for sale on underground markets. So why exploit something when you can just log right in? And then the other way is, yes, there are, you know, Recorded Future last year tracked 52 vulnerabilities, software vulnerabilities that ransomware groups use to exploit to gain initial access. So these are generally unpatched vulnerabilities. So they're known vulnerabilities, and there's generally a patch that's been released for it, but organizations don't always patch in a timely manner, which gives the ransomware actors access to these vulnerable systems.
So are the targets of an organization like Conti, are they mostly governments and organizations, or should people like you and me be taking precautions to protect ourselves against these kind of attacks?
Yeah, Conti's not necessarily interested in you and me because we can't afford the kind of ransom, at least I can't afford the kind of ransom payments that they demand. But that being said, you and I could be a conduit to our organization. They may not be specifically interested in me, but if they land on my desk because I click on a link or open a phishing email, then that becomes valuable. So I personally am not valuable, but on my corporate laptop, I could very well be valuable to them just for the access that would give them.
Alan Liska is a ransomware researcher at the cybersecurity company Recorded Future. Thanks for speaking with us, Alan.
Thank you. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Coal, oil, gas, fossil fuels. The more the world uses them, the worse climate change gets. Right now, energy is under a bright spotlight as Russia's war in Ukraine has shaken up global energy supplies. We're working on a special edition of the world that's all about energy, and we'd love your input. What are your biggest concerns and questions about energy, both for your own household and for the world at large? Email a voice memo to us. The address is myworld@theworld.org. Let us know who you are and what's top of mind for you when you think about our energy future. That's myworld@theworld.org. And listen for our special coverage later this month. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Popular culture among Mexican Americans and Mexicans has often been similar and yet quite different. Different takes on the singers Selena or Richie Valens, for example, or divergent perspectives on history and politics. A group of artists and historians from both sides of the border are working to build a cultural bridge deep in the heart of Mexico. The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia brings us this next story from Mexico City.
This is a city of contrasts between extreme wealth and extreme poverty, between the past and the present. In fact, you can be rushing down a highway jammed with traffic, then make a turn and suddenly find yourself in what looks like a small town, where a man will be ringing a bell to announce he's selling fresh sweetbread from his basket.
Hey, how are you? Cassie?
Yes.
Jorge. Mucho gusto conocerles.
It's on the cobblestone streets of the historic La Candelaria neighborhood that we meet a group of artists who've traveled from Los Angeles and San Diego. One of them is Cindy Rocha, and she's a
muralist from San Diego, yeah.
Rocha is Chicana. She's Mexican-American. And this is her first time visiting Mexico City.
I would say the biggest difference is the architecture. it's like you'll turn a corner and you'll see, whoa, hey, like there's this 1940s building here over here next to this other building that was built out of like volcanic rock. Like, to me, like, shows the character of the whole city.
Rocha and her friends came to the Candelaria neighborhood of Mexico City to paint a mural that they hope will be a connection between Chicano Mexican American culture and Mexican culture.
The title of the piece is called Flores para la Raza. So, Flores para la Raza.
Is there a way to say that in English?
Yeah, flowers for la raza. La raza is like all of us brown people.
Rocha and I spoke at the inauguration of the mural just a few days ago. It centers on an ambiguous figure that can be seen as either the head of a warrior or a beating heart. And it's framed by green and red columns similar to the ones in the historic Chicano Park in Rocha's hometown of San Diego. And all over the mural, there are flowers, like the ones artisans here in La Candelaria combine with colored sand to create ornate rugs outside of the neighborhood church once a year on the Day of the Virgin of La Candelaria.
So that's where it came from, and it's kind of like a double entendre also, because here we are planting these seeds in order for this bridge to be created.
Rocha and the other Chicano painters are collaborating with two Mexico City natives who've dedicated themselves to documenting Chicano culture from south of the border.
Alfonso Vázquez.
One of them, Alfonso Vázquez, is a PhD candidate in Mexico's National School of Anthropology and History. He recently published a book about Chicano film. He says that Mexican Americans have been stigmatized in Mexico almost as often as they have in the United States.
Durante la década de los años 40 o 50, por ejemplo, hubo toda una campaña de desprestigio hacia el migrante.
Vázquez says in the 1940s and 50s, there was an unofficial government campaign to cast a negative light on Mexicans who migrated to the United States. And words such as Chicano or Pocho were used to refer to them in the pejorative.
Hay películas, por ejemplo, Primero Soy Mexicano.
For example, Vázquez says there were films like the 1950 Primero Soy Mexicano, or I Am Mexican First. In the film, a young Mexican man returns from medical school in the United States, wanting ham and eggs for breakfast and shunning his Mexican roots.
Quien viaja a los Estados Unidos pierde su identidad de mexicano.
Vázquez says the film builds on a stereotype that any Mexican who leaves for the United States loses their identity. He says that's why he and his colleague Alejandro Torres, who studies Chicano literature, want to continue making connections between Chicano and Mexican culture.
Pues mira, para mí esto es un hilo nuevo en la historia.
Torres says the mural is a new thread and what he hopes will be a long history of connections between Chicano and Mexican culture. He and Vázquez are also collecting oral histories for Mexico's National Sound Library. For the muralist Cindy Rocha, the mural represents reconnecting with the country where her relatives are from.
I feel like it's like coming back to the belly button. This is where it all started. Like, this is the origin of our roots.
It was a sentiment that was welcomed by many passersby, like Mexico City artist Juan Silva, who a few days later was painting another mural down the street.
Que siempre cuando quieran regresen, machín, México y su cultura siempre va a estar aquí.
They are always welcome here, Silva said. Mexico and their culture will always be here. For the world, I'm Jorge Valencia in Mexico City.
Here's a sentence I never thought I'd say. Jane Goodall is starring in an underwear commercial. The world's Sarah Birnbaum has more.
To be fair, Dr. Goodall isn't modeling the underwear herself. She's bundled up in a turtleneck and a shawl, but she's surrounded by men and women wearing next to nothing in their skivvies, posing in a rainforest and staring off into space. Now, the first thing I thought when I saw this was either those models are way too cold or Jane Goodall is way too hot. Anyway, the ad is for the Australian company Booty, which makes clothing out of bamboo fabric. It starts with sunlight streaming through the trees. Cue the ambient music. Then you have Goodall doing her voiceover.
Humans. What unusual animals we are.
Then a woman in a bra and panties caresses a tree trunk. The camera zooms in on a male model in boxer briefs. Jane Goodall delivers the tagline.
It's a big job making our world a better place, but getting started, well, that's as easy as changing your underwear. Budi, official underwear of the entire planet.
What? The ad doesn't go into what that means exactly. Thankfully, Goodall connected the dots on an Australian talk show, The Project.
Bamboo is something that is very sustainable because it grows really fast and it also makes really nice soft material. So it's good for the environment and it's good for our skin and it's good for everybody.
The clothing company paid Goodall an undisclosed fee that went right to her charity. This isn't Goodall's first foray into fashion commercials. She did a voiceover for the Stella McCartney 2019 winter campaign.
Here, here and only here. Only here do we cry out, name animals, write our names on casts.
This ad wasn't quite as strange as the new one, but still plenty strange. In the ads, supermodels and members of the activist group Extinction Rebellion look fierce on the Welsh coast. Goodall reads a poem by author Jonathan Safran Foer because why not?
Here is where we plant flags, fold cranes and poker hands, take selfies, give a damn.
Jane Goodall is famous for going into the jungles of Tanzania at 26 years old to study wild chimpanzees. She was the first to discover that chimpanzees can make and use tools, a revelation that turned the scientific world upside down. Today, she's the most famous primatologist in the world. When she was on that Australian talk show, the host, who was being a bit of a jerk in my opinion, asked Goodall to think back on her younger self.
Doctor, you have so many amazing achievements. Was there ever a moment when you were in the jungle in Tanzania 60 years ago where you thought to yourself, one day I'm going to be the face of an underwear company?
Well, you could answer that yourself, couldn't you?
Was that a yes? For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
For 2 years, Taiwan has shown how a democracy functions under a zero-COVID policy. Now it's got a whole new approach, live with the virus.
Because if we don't do that, there's no way for us to return to the normal life.
Plus, A Kid and His Drum, the new children's book that celebrates the underrepresented parts of life for Indigenous Canadians. That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. A chaotic scene in Jerusalem today. Israeli police rushed into a funeral procession, swinging batons and hitting people. Mourners were leaving a hospital courtyard and attempting to carry a coffin on foot through East Jerusalem. Israeli police claimed rocks were thrown by Palestinians during the incident. The funeral procession was for Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. She was killed on Wednesday in the West Bank. Oren Ziv was present at the funeral procession today. He's a reporter and photojournalist with the independent news site Local Call and 972 magazine. He joins us now from Tel Aviv. Oren, what did you witness at the funeral procession today?
Hard for me to remember such a brutal event where the Israeli police chose to break into the French hospital in East Jerusalem before even the funeral procession and march started, attacking the people with batons, with stun grenades, pushing people, the family, the colleagues, many journalists who came both to cover the funeral but also to take part. The idea of some of the Palestinian youth who were at the place at the French hospital was to march by foot. The police didn't want that to happen. They wanted the coffin to be taken by a car directly to the church. And when people started to organize to march outside with Palestinian flags, the police just attacked them. Later, a few bottles were thrown, but it's very clear that the police, first of all, approached the people inside the yard, the parking lot of the hospital, and brutally attacked them. I also was pushed and hit, and many of my colleagues, and although we were marked as journalists and we were there just to cover the event.
I want to make sure I understand it. What the family and other friends and supporters of Shireen had wanted was to carry her casket from the hospital to the church where the funeral was going to happen?
Yes, exactly. As in many Palestinian funerals, and especially political funerals, in order for many members of the public to see the funeral, to take part, it usually marches by foot from one point to another. And the police wanted it to happen by car, maybe so they can only allow a few cars out of the hospital and then block the crowd. After they did allow the car to leave, they blocked us and the family and many other people from leaving for about half an hour. So we were late for the church and for the other part of the service. But the idea is that they don't want Palestinian flags seen in East Jerusalem. They don't want any kind of protest. And for them, although it was not really a usual protest, and most of the people there didn't come to confront the police, take part in the service, the police acted as it was something that needed to be dispersed.
You mentioned the Palestinian flag, and the Palestinian flag was draped on Shireen's coffin, wasn't it?
The police didn't touch the coffin, but throughout the funeral, police was confiscating flags, even signs in Arabic. They didn't want any sign to show that she was a Palestinian journalist. And of course, for the people who came to the funeral, it was very important to express that. It's not just a normal funeral. She was killed during her job in the Jenin refugee camp during armed clashes between the Israeli army and the local militants.
From where you were standing, did you see any rocks or projectiles thrown before the Israeli police started rushing the mourners?
No, not at all. Only after a young man threw some plastic bottles or whatever they couldn't find, but definitely not. Also, the police, even before they rushed into the hospital yard, they announced that if people would not stop chanting slogans, they would have to disperse the funeral. So it was very clear that it wasn't because people went to attack them. It's because they wanted to prevent any expression of the fact she was Palestinian. She was part of the Palestinian people. And I have to say also, we haven't seen such a scene through all across the West Bank and East Jerusalem, people joining the different services and ceremonies to pay respect to her, because she was really a well-known figure.
Israel has called for an investigation into Shireen's killing, but Palestinians are refusing to cooperate or hand over evidence, claiming Israeli bias and a history of these investigations going nowhere. How likely is an investigation to move forward at this point?
I've talked to her colleagues, friends, even family members, and of course they call for an international investigation. They say, and I must agree, that Israel has a very bad record of investigating itself, the Israeli army. It cannot be that the Israeli army will investigate itself. We've seen in hundreds of cases from the killing in the different operations in Gaza and in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, how most of those investigations are just to cover up, even when there's witnesses, even when there's footage of the killing, or even when there's clear proof that the person who was killed didn't do anything or didn't show any threat to the Israeli forces. So, of course, it's very clear why they don't trust the Israelis and why they didn't want a joint investigation.
Oren Ziv is a journalist and photographer with independent Israeli news sites Local Call and 972 magazine. He spoke to us from Tel Aviv. Thank you so much, Oren.
Thank you very much.
Since the pandemic began, Taiwan has been a role model for fighting COVID. The island of 23 million has recorded fewer than 1,000 deaths since the pandemic began. Despite its success using a zero COVID strategy, Taiwan is now shifting gears to a living with COVID plan. Joining me now to discuss this is Dr. Shen Chen-Jen. He's an epidemiologist and former vice president of Taiwan. Dr. Chen, what policies regarding COVID were in place in Taiwan that kept death rates so low?
Oh, the first phase was from December 2019 to November 2020, when vaccine was not available. In this first phase, what we could do was the interruption of viral transmission through non-pharmaceutical intervention, NPI, with the aim to reach zero COVID-19. Basically, we did not lock down any city and we did not carry out mass testing. And the most important thing is very careful and intensive contact tracing. And from January 1st, 2020 to the end of 2021, more than 1 million people have been home isolated or home quarantined. And through this way, we have very good containment of COVID-19 in Taiwan. And by the end of 2020, our COVID-19 confirmed case rate was the lowest in the world.
That's remarkable. Then what was the next step? How did you change things up after that?
After the vaccine was available, we tried our best to increase our vaccine coverage. However, at the very beginning, it is very difficult for us to get adequate vaccine from an international company. So our vaccination program started very late. However, by the end of 2021, more than 80% of the people in Taiwan already got the complete vaccination. So the vaccination rate is high in Taiwan, and we have to thank 23 million people in Taiwan. They are really the unsung hero here.
So a combination of Moderna, Taiwan's own vaccine, and others.
All this combination were used, yeah.
So now you're changing things up again. What's the latest strategy?
After this Omicron variant arose in South Africa, and the virus spread so quickly, has a very high infectivity and very low death rate, we have to adopt the new policy, that's to live with the virus. But if we want to live with the virus, we definitely have to prepare three important things. The first one is to increase our vaccine booster coverage. And the second thing is to prepare adequate antivirals for the community private clinician. And the third one is to prepare adequate rapid test also for the private practitioner. And fortunately, by May, we have adequate antivirals and rapid tests. So now we are adopting the policy of live with the virus.
So it was the Omicron variant that really persuaded you to change the strategy. What are the risks with this change in strategy?
We have to be careful because our Omicron spread out very quick. And current vaccine cannot prevent infection. However, it can prevent severe cases and prevent deaths. So we have to educate our people that don't worry about the spread of the infection of the Omicron variant. The most important thing we have to pay attention to is the mortality as well as the severe cases. And fortunately, by now, our death number can be kept as low as possible. And the death rate among the infected people is 0.02%. It's around 2 per 10,000. So we kept it very low. We try to move up our healthcare unit to help taking care of the severe cases.
Now, I know that Omicron, it spreads wildly, but hospitalizations are low and people tend not to get really sick. But are you still concerned that the number of COVID-related deaths could rise in Taiwan?
Yes. The reason for that is in Taiwan, around 5 to 10% of the people did not receive this booster shot. The reason for that is our entire vaccination program was around 6 months later than other countries. So it will be at the end of June, we can increase our vaccine booster coverage up to 80%. And another challenge is if the case number increases very rapidly, if everyone rushes to this medical center or hospitals, of course, this healthcare capacity will be affected. That's the reason why we try our best to distribute rapid diagnostic and antivirals to the community and ask more than 2,000 private clinicians to help us to do this rapid diagnostic and to prescribe antiviral to those who need the prescription.
So you're really trying to spread the vaccine and the boosters around to make sure people have easy access to them instead of having them administered at a hospital or central place.
That's right. Accessibility in the community, it definitely is very important.
Do you think Taiwan's approach, this kind of new embrace of living with COVID, do you think it can be applied to other countries that have until now tried the zero COVID approach?
Yeah, I think that some of the countries adopted this zero COVID may try to learn what Taiwan's shift from zero COVID to live with the virus. Because if we don't do that, there's no way for us to return to the normal life. And especially if we want to lock down the city or do mass testing, it will cost a lot. And then it will damage the economy a lot. And in Taiwan, we use our policy and we have very good economic growth. Not only the 3.11% in 2020, and in 2021, our GDP growth rate is 6.26. It's quite good too. So, and in any kind of a pandemic containment, we definitely have to pay attention to not only the containment of the pandemic, and also the have to promote that economic growth.
I was going to ask, because looking across the Taiwan Strait, Beijing has stuck to a very strict zero COVID policy in China. How long do you think they can keep that up?
It is mission impossible. The reason for that is they seems to eliminate the virus through the lockdown. But once they open this kind of lockdown policy, I believe that the virus will spread out very quickly. And even World Health Organization give the warning to China that it cannot be done to totally eliminate the virus in any country. So zero COVID is not an appropriate policy at all.
You know, I wanted to ask you one thing. I mean, Taipei and Beijing don't get along at all. But when it comes to public health, do you two collaborate or discuss strategies, or do those discussions just not happen?
We used to sign a bilateral memorandum to exchange information about the pandemic and to collaborate on this and public health issues. But unfortunately, in recent 3 to 4 years, this kind of collaboration was interrupted. And we want to promote bilateral collaboration. And it's not only one side. Both sides have to cooperate with each other. And we are willing to help, but we're still waiting for the response from across the strait.
Dr. Chen Jianchen is an epidemiologist and a former vice president of Taiwan. He's been speaking to us from Taipei. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Books can make a huge impact on kids. Characters teach them about faraway places and let children see themselves as heroes of the story. But not everyone gets to see their lives represented on the page. One author in Canada is working to change that for his community. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
23-year-old Ren Louis is a member of the Ahauzit First Nation and was raised in an urban part of Victoria, British Columbia.
Not on reserve or in our home community.
Louis says he remembers flipping through books, looking for stories of Indigenous kids like himself. But they were either written by non-Indigenous authors or portrayed a static version of his community.
It talks about a certain time of Indigenous people, you know, before contact. It makes the assumptions that we still have all of those practices and that kind of lifestyle. After a while, you know, not seeing myself reflected in the books, I felt disengaged with reading.
At home, his family more than made up for this lack of representation. Early on, they taught him about their shared Indigenous culture, including traditional music and songs.
You know, they played in the car and in the house regularly. And when I was 8 years old, I actually, you know, started singing and I got my first drum. And from there, you know, I haven't looked back.
Louis says there was no shortage of teachers. His uncle, grandma, and aunt all helped him learn how to play his 10-inch drum, which was handmade by his mom. He quickly became enticed by the rhythm.
I used to take that drum with me, you know, like when we were going out to the grocery store, I would play the drum. That was just always my thing.
15 years later, Louis still has that very first drum. And he's putting his story down on paper in his debut children's book called Drum from the Heart. The picture book follows a young kid who gains confidence and learns about his culture by singing traditional Nuchalnuth songs. He wrote it during a gap year from college. Louis says it was important to him that the story wasn't rooted in trauma.
These stories chip away at all kinds of ignorance, and it shows that we're a dynamic culture. It shows that we're healthy people, and we're ordinary families.
The illustrations show the young boy playing his drum with his family. Louis hopes the book inspires kids to learn their own culture.
And that's not limited just to Indigenous children, but children from all cultures, from all around the world. You know, whether that's an instrument from their culture or picking up food from their culture and learning how to cook that food. They could talk to their parents and grandparents and learn a little bit more about what their family's done and, you know, try to make that a part of themselves.
Drum from the Heart comes out this Sunday. For the World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The world is a big place, and we're here to help you connect with stories and places that you may have missed. From vivid descriptions of what it's like to live under COVID-19 lockdowns in Shanghai, China, to the music and politics of this year's Eurovision Song Contest, and Indigenous languages that are now available on Google Translate. Discover these stories and more on our Twitter feed. We are at The World. Mosquitoes are among the least liked beings on the planet. They're more than just a blood-sucking nuisance. One species in particular carries Zika, dengue, and yellow fever. Those viruses cause birth defects, sickness, and death in tropical regions across the Americas, Africa, and Asia. The World's Stephen Snyder looked into some new research that shows how this one mosquito is so effective at targeting humans.
Its name is Aedes aegypti.
It's a human specialist.
This human specialist's ability to target humans was the focus of a team of researchers, including Princeton PhD candidate Jessica Zong.
You probably know, like, they detect CO2, they detect heat, they use vision. But one thing that's actually quite important for them is olfaction.
Olfaction, the sense of smell. Zong's job was to collect samples of odors to test on the mosquitoes.
In order to get human body odor, you want people to be as stinky as possible.
And so human volunteers were recruited.
So we decided, like, 3 days, 3 days no showering. That's, you know, reasonable. Most people would be probably willing to do that, at least for science.
Next step, blow air across people's bodies to collect the odors. They had to step into a body bag to do that.
The person strips down naked, goes into this bag, just their head poking out. There's a little blanket on top for modesty's sake. And then the person will lie there for 2 hours.
Song collected the odors of people, plus dogs, sheep, guinea pigs, quail, and rats, to be sniffed in the lab by specially bred mosquitoes. Another team member monitored a mosquito's brain activity while it was exposed to different smells.
We want to open up their head and try to figure out what they are thinking when they smell humans.
Tsule Chow, now at Cornell, was a member of the Princeton team. He bred genetically modified mosquitoes whose microscopic brains would be illuminated, like a light bulb, when their olfactory neurons were stimulated. He also performed surgery on each mosquito subject.
So what we need to do is we need to open up the head, use like very tiny forceps. Just open it up so their brain is exposed.
Yep, tiny forceps. We're talking about the head of a mosquito.
So you need to be very gentle under the microscope.
And what Chow saw under the microscope was surprising. The mosquito was being exposed to lots of different animal odors, so he was expecting dozens of parts of the mosquito brain to light up in response. But instead, just two of the mosquito's nerve centers were affected.
One of those only responded to human odor.
That's the Princeton lab director, Professor Lindy McBride. She says that the other stimulus to excite the mosquito was carbon dioxide, which comes from the breath of humans, of course, but from every other animal as well.
The fact that these two compounds are quite abundant in a blend that is otherwise animal-like indicates that it's a human odor.
And that's what the mosquito named Aedes aegypti is looking for. The team's paper, published this month in the journal Nature, is raising more questions, like, how did this human-seeking behavior evolve in this species of mosquito, and why? And now that we know which chemical this mosquito is sniffing for, how can this knowledge be used to prevent diseases that continue to ravage many parts of the world? For The World, this is Stephen Snyder.
When it comes to perfume, consumers are spoiled for choice.
1 million. Fragrance for Men by Paco Rabanne.
J'adore. Dior.
Night. The new fragrance for men.
Beauty magazines will tell you to go with your nose. Your fragrance is personal. Turns out it's not as personal as you might think. A study out last month from researchers in Sweden and the UK found that people tend to like the same smells, no matter where they're from. So what's the most popular scent out there? Vanilla. Followed by peaches. At the bottom of the list, sweaty feet. So next time you're at the perfume counter, stay away from Eau de Locker Room. Marmite, a thick, yeasty paste, typically served on toast, began as a British thing. The lyrics, if you didn't catch them, are "My mate, Marmite." The gooey sludge made from the byproducts of beer brewing is popular in a lot of former British colonies. Some of the biggest Marmite fans are in South Africa. That's why a shortage there has caused what Dylan Barry, a contributing writer with The Economist, describes as Marmageddon.
It's become essentially impossible to find Marmite on shelves, in supermarkets and grocery stores. I would estimate that there are several million Marmite-deprived South Africans who continue to weather the worst Marmite shortage in the country since the end of apartheid.
For anyone who hates Marmite, and there are many who do, this might be no big deal. But keep listening, because the reasons behind the shortage are actually quite interesting.
Marmite production is a surprisingly complicated process. But one of the key ingredients it relies on is brewer's yeast, which is a byproduct of beer fermentation. So at the beginning of the pandemic, South Africa somewhat uniquely banned alcohol sales during its deepest COVID lockdowns. As a consequence of the bans, South African Breweries, which is a big local beer monopoly, cut beer production almost entirely. Unfortunately, when the beer dried up, so did the yeast.
But the last ban was lifted 9 months ago. So Dylan Barry was puzzled why he couldn't find Marmite on the shelves around Johannesburg, where he lives. That's when he discovered there's a second reason for the Marmite crisis.
There's been a shortage of another raw material. It's not really an ingredient in the production of Marmite. It's not on the label or anything like that. But it's quite important in the broader production process. And this is something called soda ash, which is also known by its chemical name, sodium carbonate. That shortage has really dried up production of Marmite. In addition, there appear to have been water supply issues to Marmite South Africa's big factory just outside Johannesburg.
The company says they've located new supplies of soda ash and this week announced they're introducing double shifts at the Marmite plant. But even though production has ramped up, as soon as the jars land on the shelves, the company says they're getting snapped up. So how long can South Africans go on like this without knowing when they'll get their hands on their next jar of Marmite?
Well, South Africans love Marmite. And it's one of the few things that can really genuinely be said to transcend the boundaries of race and class in South Africa. Most South Africans have a jar of Marmite in their cupboards, whether rich or poor or black or white, whether in some of the richest areas of Johannesburg or some of the poorest townships. Marmite is all over the place. And as a consequence, South Africans are pretty perturbed by the disappearance of Marmite from shelves.
That was writer Dylan Barry speaking about Marmite, the British topping you either love or hate. Dylan Barry appeared on The Intelligence, a podcast from our partners at The Economist. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. Enjoy your weekend and see you right back here on Monday.
From PRX.